Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, September 4th, 2017. South Sudan government spokesman says the country does not need a regional protection force.
Juba is at peace, but when somebody comes and he sees this UN moving just like that with their guns, now what message will that person take away with him? This is the situation we don't want. And this is why we are talking of revisiting the mandate.
And a former top SPLM official calls on President Kiir to step down.
The situation really in South Sudan has gotten to an extreme dire level. So much influx of refugees into neighboring countries, high level of insecurity almost in every corner of South Sudan. The economy is so ailing, it's not completely collapsed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Members of the South Sudan government are questioning the mandate of the Regional Protection Force deployed in the country to protect civilians and humanitarian agencies. Information Minister Michael Makuei says the country is peaceful and there is no need for the deployment of the additional 4,000 UN-backed Regional Protection Force in Juba. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu reports from the capital.
Addressing journalists at a press conference last week, Information Minister Michael Makuei said the presence of the UN forces in South Sudan sends the wrong message.
Juba is at peace, but when somebody comes and he sees this UN moving just like that with their guns, now what message will that person take away with him? This is the situation we don't want. And this is why we are talking of revisiting the mandate.
The deployment of 4,000 regional protection forces was authorized by the UN Security Council Resolution 2304 last year. The United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, says the force will provide protection to key facilities in Juba and many routes into and out of the capital. The force will also strengthen the security of the UN-protected civilians' sites and other UN premises. Makuei insists the mandate of the force should be reviewed after it expires in December.
With the end of the mandate, with the end of the period in December, the government of South Sudan must be consulted before they talk of renewing anything. This idea of renewing or this automatic renewal without the involvement of the government of South Sudan is not acceptable and will not happen.
UNMISS spokesperson Daniel Dickinson says the United Nations mission in South Sudan is following the instructions from the UN Security Council.
I think the position is that...
Well, I think the position is that if the Security Council reaches a new mandate with the RPF, so UNMISS follows the resolution, the mandate passed by the Security Council.
UN Security Council Resolution 2304 was adopted in August last year following renewed violence in Juba. Article 8 of the UN Security Council Resolution gives RPF the powers to provide a secure environment in Juba and in other violent-prone areas of South Sudan. So far, the United Nations has deployed at least 500 RPF in the capital, Juba, and more peacekeepers are expected to arrive in the country. James Okuk is a lecturer of political science at the University of Juba. Okuk says there are two ways Juba can deal with the RPF.
It depends on smart diplomacy that Juba can employ in New York. If they don't employ smart diplomacy and they think they can do it arrogantly, they are going to lose it because the RPF might not get away from South Sudan as far as war continues. Unless if they stop the war, then the RPF become irrelevant.
Makuei's latest remarks follows a recent standoff between UNMISS and the government over the deployment of Rwandan peacekeepers near Juba Airport. The remarks sparked reactions from South Sudanese. Juba town resident Suro Nelson says he is not convinced Juba is peaceful.
There is robbery, and this robbery actually is always being named by the name of unknown government. Where are these unknown government? And the government is not able to find out this unknown government. And three, there is no free movement. There is no freedom of movement, especially even at 7 p.m. you want to go to another area or whatever case or emergency, you'll find yourself attacked on the way. And even highways, highways are not totally free. People cannot move freely from one area, from one town to another.
Another Juba resident who only prefers to be identified only as KG for fear of government retaliation shares Nelson's feelings. She says the country needs the regional protection force now.
There is no peace in the country because a lot of things are still happening, a lot. People are still killing each other. There's still a lot of things which are happening. What citizens of South Sudanese need right now is protection. Security is what we need.
UNMISS Chief David Sierra said last month that the deployment of the regional protection forces allows existing UNMISS troops based in Juba to be reassigned to other locations across South Sudan to protect vulnerable civilians, support humanitarian assistance, and monitor and report on human rights abuses. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A former senior member of the Sudan People's... A former senior member of South Sudan's ruling party, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, is calling on President Salva Kiir to end the conflict in the country. The former SPLM Secretary for External Affairs, Susan Jambu, says in a recorded video on the social media that Mr. Kiir has failed to resolve the conflict in the country and he should admit his mistakes and resign.
The situation really in South Sudan has gotten to an extreme dire level. So much influx of refugees into neighboring countries, high level of insecurity almost in every corner of South Sudan. The economy is so ailing, it's not completely collapsed.
You were once an inner circle in the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the SPLM. What kind of a person is President Kiir? You seem to know him very well. What kind of a person is he? Does he listen to people? Does he take advices? What kind of a person is he?
I have had a number of observations about him. He would listen. He would actually come out of his way, call you, call for a meeting with you, for example, some of his most trusted people that he finds, and then he would call you, and then he would ask you, there is this situation, that situation, what can we do? He consults along those lines. So then you give your utmost sincere recommendations, consultation, ideas, suggestions, etc., and analysis and all that. And you would come out of that meeting, normally a one-on-one meeting, and normally no less than 2 to 3 hours. He never fulfilled any of the innermost discussions of things to do with reforms. The president makes time to listen. 2 to 3 hours. But nothing happens. Nothing changes. The status quo remains and remained.
You've been part of the system. Why are you bitter now?
Honestly, as a human being, you would wish to believe that a person that you are having one-on-one consultative discussions based on mutual profit and based on promises, you'd hope to think that the person is genuine and you'd hope to think that something will come out of it. The situation is not getting any better, has not gotten any better. Peace talks upon peace talks, whether it's in Addis Ababa, it's Bahar Dar in Ethiopia, or Arusha, or even in Juba. Discussions on peace and inputs on peace and everything, and nothing was changing.
There were people who have been saying exactly what you are saying today. And in the past, you would rubbish them or you would attack them and you would say you call them names even. I remember reading one of your discussion on the internet with some people in the diaspora when you call them names that they are just complainers and they don't know what is happening. And you were attacking them when they were saying the same things you're saying today.
At the time when these discussions were taking place, we're talking about late 2013 to mid-2014. In that span of 8 months or so, all of us had hopes that, you know, we could actually put things together. Political parties in South Sudan, in Juba, joined hands with SPLM, as well as we reached out to the IGAD countries, and they began to adapt the process of making peace. That is a number one factor that made me hopeful that we could possibly achieve peace. There were no any situation that was getting any worse than what it is right now. The comparison between that period and this period made me, being the person that I was then and the person I am today, because of the escalation of the situation now, I am who I am today.
What are you up to in your new role now, attacking President Kiir and attacking the party that you used to be a member?
The new Sudan is still the same old Sudan, a nationalist at heart and a patriot. Always wanted and look forward toward a better and a real good South Sudan based on our aspirations as South Sudanese from when we started our first liberation movement in Anyanga One in 1955. That is the one where we have freedom, equality and justice among the people of South Sudan, of all the communities, without any domination.
Someone listening to us in Juba right now would say, why is Suzanne Jambo speaking from outside? She should have spoken from Juba, inside Juba, so that people know that you are genuine. Why are you speaking from outside?
Everybody knows what national security is doing in Juba. You won't believe it, but even when I was in the system, my home was targeted a few times. Armed people would come, invade the house, any time of the day, any day of the week, from around mid-2012. People in uniform, people in military vehicles or national security vehicles would come and ask for me. I had to live in hideouts between that period up to the time when I had to flee the country, because it got into a point where even my own family members being attacked, two of my brothers being attacked and almost dying.
If a senior person like you in the party is not able to articulate the issues in the party, not able to point the mistakes, and not able to call on the leadership about their mistakes, who is going to speak?
Nobody. Nobody. Because, you know, the next thing that happens to you is what happened to some human rights activists. They disappear, taken into some hotels, beaten up, disappeared for days, and they appear completely beaten up, intimidated. Journalists that have been beaten up, threatened, harassed for having speaking the truth, speaking facts or questioning certain acts or inaction by the government, and so forth and so on. So basically, all these kind of intimidations.
That's Susan Jambo, the former SPLM Secretary for External Affairs. She was speaking to me from Maputo, Mozambique, earlier today. Some Juba residents say the government should focus on bringing lasting peace to the country and fixing the economy before talking about holding elections. South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makui told reporters last week the government is prepared to hold election in 6 months' time. Residents say once there is peace, elections can be held. Nabil Biajo has more for VOA from Juba.
Juba resident Victoria Andrea, who lives in Nyakran West, says she welcomes holding elections if it brings real change to the country's leadership. Speaking in Arabic, Andrea says, right now, South Sudan needs peace.
There is no peace. Insecurity is everywhere and a lot of other problems. How can we hold elections when we are still at war? It's not right. First of all, let's have peace among ourselves and then we go for election. Let's fix our economy and then we hold elections.
Juba resident Dukes David agrees. David says, even though he likes the idea of voting for new leaders, there must first be peace.
There are a lot of things that need to be put into the right path before the election start. Things like to do with security. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of insecurity cases that is going on and that needs to be tackled by government first. And also the economy, yeah, we're still suffering. There are a lot of things going on and I think those are things that they should have looked at.
Maryam Mike, who lives in the Gumbu Sharikat neighborhood, says she would support holding elections if they bring real change to the country.
If they are ready to make an election, we are ready for that election to be held. We want our nation to have change because we have experienced a lot of negative acts, so we need our change.
The South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections, or SUNDE, released a statement today saying that the transitional government of national unity is not ready to hold elections at the end of the transitional period, which is 6 months from now. SUNDE Executive Director Rajab Mohandi says current conditions in South Sudan are not suitable for elections.
The reason is that the country has not done adequate preparations for the legal frameworks that would facilitate elections. The constitution has not been reviewed as provided for in the agreement. The Elections Act and the Political Parties Act, which are crucial legislations guiding governing elections, have not been reviewed as well.
And Muhandi says, the National Elections Commission will not be ready to hold elections in 6 months either.
We have not, as a country, put together the institutions necessary for the conduct of elections. The most importantly, the Elections Commission has not been reconstituted as the agreement demands. And if it is reconstituted today, the commission will not have enough time to do all the necessary preparations for elections.
The civil activist says the National Elections Commission would have to recruit and train election officials, set up geographic electoral constituencies, prepare voter registration and educate the public on voting procedures. But above all, Muhandi says, rampant insecurity makes holding elections impossible in 6 months.
There is still violence going on around the country, and we cannot hold elections effectively.
Muhandi says the high-level revitalization forum set up by IGAD to revive the 2015 peace agreement is one way to review and revise the timeline for fully implementing the peace deal. He says elections should come only after the peace accord is fully implemented. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biaju in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, stray dogs have taken over the streets of Bor Town. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands. That is craft work, making the baskets and doing more of the clay artwork.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers, so for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice, so I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Residents of Jonglei State capital Bor are calling on the state authorities to remove hundreds of homeless dogs running through the streets. Town residents say the stray dogs attack livestock and scare people. The director of veterinary services in Bor says his office has no resources to mobilize health workers to remove the dogs from Bor. Deng Guy Deng has the story for VOA from Bor Town.
35-year-old Bor Town resident Abraham Alewanyet says the large number of stray dogs in Bor Town is not only a serious threat to livestock, but to small children as well.
The dog become very wild nowadays and they become many. So they just moving between houses and the children never know, even people are not concerning very much, but dog are biting people there and here.
Aliu says state officials should order the removal of stray dogs to avoid the spread of rabies across Bor Town. Rabies is a viral disease that causes inflammation of the brain in humans and other mammals. The disease is often transmitted through the bite of a sick animal. 23-year-old Bor resident Lue Dalier says he is uncomfortable walking to work while all kinds of wild dogs are barking at him.
Earlier this morning when I was coming to the place of work, so the dog barked at me and it was chasing me seriously. So I was so scared. Went to say to our authorities of the state and those of the municipality council at least to take this issue seriously because wild dogs in the town is become rampant.
Abraham Atiang Aluong is a community leader at Block 4 Safhab in Bor Town. Aluong says stray dogs ate some of his goats last week.
Our life is goat and cow, but maybe dog
destroy any goat and sheep and cow.
Eating even my place now, eating three goat. Yeah, I need dog to be killed, all of them. Because dog now, we are not eating dog. We're eating goat.
Zhongli State Director of Veterinary Service, Ge Wun Thuy, says his office needs 200,000 South Sudanese pounds to pay health workers who would act as animal control workers and remove the wild dogs from the streets by killing them.
We have received an information, and we also have seen it ourselves, that dogs have multiplied in Bo Town. And they are even attacking goats, cattle, even human beings. They are attacking people in the town, and we are aware of that. We are preparing if we can get at least poison to be brought, and it is not here in the town. It is brought from Nairobi using dollar.
Wun Thuy says his office will request that the Bo Town municipality avail money for buying the poison needed to kill the stray dogs. Machar Macholdeng, the deputy mayor for administrations and finance in Bo municipality, says his office is only responsible for keeping the town clean and disposing of dead stray dogs. Machol hedges residents of Bo Town to protect themselves against stray dogs, while the government looks for the funds to remove the dogs from the streets. For VOA News, I am Dengaiding in Bo.
In unprecedented ruling, Kenya's Supreme Court on Friday nullified the results of the recent presidential election and called for new polls within 60 days. The Kenya Independent Electoral Boundaries Commission has set October 17 as the new date for another election. From Nairobi, Jill Craig has more about what happens next.
The Supreme Court's decision to annul the victory of President Uhuru Kenyatta puts the country in uncharted territory. Adams Olo is a senior lecturer at the University of Nairobi.
It's the first time that one arm of the government, and specifically the judiciary, has been brave enough, if I can use those words, to stick to the constitutional provisions and the rule of law, and therefore overturn the declaration of a sitting president who was declared president-elect.
And the clock is now ticking, after the court ruled that fresh polls must be held within 60 days. Kenya's presidential spokesman said Monday that the government will not replace the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, a decision that will no doubt anger the opposition, which said Friday that the panel committed criminal acts and that most belong in jail. Nanjala Nyabola is a Nairobi-based writer and political analyst. She argues that low public confidence in the IEBC will be a big concern going into the next election and believes the commissioner should resign.
In good conscience, if they look at the indictment that they've received from the justices, they should consider stepping aside and letting their alternates take their position. That would be the ideal situation.
Kenyan political writer and commentator Barack Maluka says the short time frame could work, given that this election will be different from the one August 8th.
They could, also take solace in the knowledge that previously they were dealing with six elections and that this time round they're dealing with one election. They could also take comfort in the fact that it shouldn't be difficult for them to know where they dropped the ball, who dropped the ball, and to deal with that particular individual or with those individuals.
Kenyatta and opposition candidate Raila Odinga didn't waste time in getting back in campaign mode over the weekend, speaking to large crowds of supporters in Nairobi, Thika, and Nakuru. Kenyatta said he will respect the court ruling, but referred to Supreme Court justices as wakora, a Swahili word for crooks. Odinga has continued to condemn the Electoral Commission. In the meantime, Kenyans are still waiting for the release of the Supreme Court's full judgment, which is required within 21 days of the ruling. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations estimates that there are nearly 23 million refugees in the world today. Many are children who live in dangerous conditions such as war or drought, including South Sudan. Recently, several new books have been published to help dramatize and explain the plight of refugee children to young readers. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Suzanne Del Rizzo is the Canadian author and illustrator of My Beautiful Birds. It's a book for young readers based on a true story about Sami, a Syrian boy who raised birds on his rooftop before his family was forced to flee the war. Here Del Rizzo reads an excerpt from the book where the grieving boy tears up a picture he's made of his birds at a refugee camp in Jordan.
I tear my painting piece by piece. Black paint stains my hands and my clothes. My stained heart is torn to pieces, too. Outside I run to escape the blackness.
Del Rizzo was inspired to write a book about refugee children as the mother of four children of her own. Her kids had seen many images of suffering refugees on television and asked her, "Will war come here? Where are they all fleeing to? Will someone help them? Are those children safe now?"
And it was really hard for me as a parent because, you know, you want to be truthful. Kids are so smart and they deserve honesty in your discussions of important issues like this. But you also want to make sure that they always feel safe and secure and that you tell them the facts, but in a way that's appropriate to their age level.
When Del Rizzo searched online for true life stories of child refugees, she learned about a boy who raised birds at home but was forced to abandon them when the family fled. But he later found wild birds to care for in a refugee camp.
And I thought it was so profound because it transcends language and it speaks to a child's universal love of animals and the comfort that they can bring during hard times, like especially during something as traumatic as displacement, in a way that would hopefully grab the reader and also help them like connect and empathize with the main character.
Canadian author Margaret Rohr's book, Stepping Stones, chronicles the journey of a Syrian refugee family on its way to safety in Europe. The illustrations are beautifully rendered entirely in pebbles and small stones by the Syrian artist Nisar Alibader. The story begins with the happy life of a little girl named Rama before calamity struck.
I started with a simple picture of a rooster, the breaking of dawn in a village in Syria where the child wakes up from the rooster crowing. So the book describes life before war and then what happens when war comes and when people have to start fleeing. And when her father, Rama's father, finally says it's time for us to join that river of people.
Roars opens to the page that shows the river of refugees, just like Rama and her family had become.
A river of strangers in search of a place to be free, to live and love, to laugh again, in search of a place where bombs did not fall, where people did not die on their way to market. A river of people in search of peace.
Roars ends the story on a hopeful note.
When Rama reaches the end of the land, there is the sea that they now have to try and cross. It was dangerous. And when they make it, there are people whose words she doesn't understand, but their outstretched arms and their smiles show her that they are welcome to stay. And they don't know if they'll stay forever or if they maybe be able to go back home one day.
Life does not always offer up happy endings. That's plain in Alan Gratz's book, Refugee. It's a book geared to kids between 9 and 13 years old. It features three parallel stories of child refugees. Joseph, a German Jewish boy escaping the Nazis in 1939, Isabel, a girl fleeing Castro's Cuba by raft in 1994, and Mahmoud, a Syrian boy, escaping his war-ravaged homeland in 2015. Each child suffers tragedy and triumph in their own way.
And so one of the things I wanted to do with this book was to show young readers that there is no one face for refugees. They could be different religions. They can be different races. They can be from different places. They can be from different economic levels.
Gratz notes that even the meaning of the word refugee has changed, at least in the U.S.
We used to hear the word refugee, and in our mind, we pictured somebody who needed help, people who were forced to flee their country. We met people who were called refugees with open arms and said, "Come to America. We have room for you. We care about you. We want to help you."
Gratz says that most refugees now living in America come from Africa, not the Middle East. Still, for many Americans, the word refugee equals Muslim. The authors of these books share the wish that the hard luck stories of those real-life children will end with ease and happiness. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
That's our show for this Monday. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.